Well, good afternoon. Thank you for joining me today. My name is Richard Clem, and we're coming to you today from St. Paul, Minnesota. It's Friday, September 21st, 2012, where we're doing our live program, for which we've applied for CLE credit in Minnesota, Wisconsin, and Iowa. And we are also coming to you via our webcast, both an audio and video version. Either one is available for Wisconsin credit, and the video version, but not the audio version, I have applied for Iowa credit. During the course of the program, I'll be giving three sets of code words. One set I will be speaking into the audio, and the other set of code words will be displayed on your on the video. For attorneys taking the program in Wisconsin, you can give me either set of code words, either the audio or the video code words. If you're taking the program for Iowa credit, in order to give you that certificate of attendance, you will need to give me the video code words that are shown on the screen, and you don't have to worry about the audio code words. So, well, once again, welcome. Today we're going to be talking about First Amendment issues in K-12 education. And obviously, since we're only spending 50 minutes talking about that topic, we're obviously going to do little more than just hit the high points. But I think this program will be helpful just to allow practitioners who might occasionally counter those issues to be able to recognize the issues, because they do have a tendency to come up. And also, I hope today's program might be of some benefit to educators. To understand not necessarily what the resolution of any particular issue is going to be, but at least to recognize the issues and to understand when guidance might be necessary. Well, as you can see in the materials, I start with just the text of the First Amendment. The First Amendment to the U.S. Constitution, and you know, obviously it covers a lot of ground, but covers it very fast. And you know, that's been the subject of a couple of centuries worth of litigation. So obviously there's a lot more meaning there that can be just expressed in a few clauses in the actual text of the Constitution. But it's always important, I think, just to you know, look back and see what the text of the amendment actually says, because it covers a number of issues that are relevant to today's subject. Starts out by saying Congress shall pass no law. Well, of course, with the adoption of the 14th Amendment after the Civil War, basically the Supreme Court has held that most of the liberties guaranteed by the rest of the Bill of Rights are also restrictions upon the actions of the state. So when it says Congress shall make no law, it really means neither Congress nor the states or any of the subdivisions of the state, such as school districts, can make any law or take any action regarding any of the following: the establishment of religion, prohibiting the free exercise of religion, abridging the freedom of speech or of the press, the right of the people to peaceably assemble, and to petition the government for redress of grievances. So obviously in the education environment, those are issues that arise occasionally. You know, what is a school allowed to do, or what is a school required to do with respect to religious beliefs of the students? School is an environment where speech takes place, so that comes up frequently. The press, even things like school yearbooks and school newspapers, there might be some restrictions upon government action with respect to those. Obviously, students peaceably assemble every day to attend school, and sometimes they have grievances that they want to seek redress of. So we're in the 50 minutes that we have today, we're going to, like I say, just hit the high points of all those issues. Obviously, in this limited amount of time after two centuries of litigation, we're probably not going to be able to come to a firm resolution on many of these issues. But we'll hit the high points. And we'll start just on the subject of school speech. Kind of the leading case on that subject is this Tinker versus Des Moines Independent School District. which is a case of the United States Supreme Court from 1969. After almost half a century, almost half a century since that decision, in some respects, it seems rather tame what the students did in this case. The students were protesting the Vietnam War, and they decided to have kind of a concerted protest of the Vietnam War. And what the students decided to do was wear black armbands to school. Rather tame. Well, the school administration caught wind of this, and they believed that would cause a disruption. One of the things that they believed, perhaps correctly, perhaps incorrectly, but what they believed in any event was that, these students wearing the black armbands, they're going to be peaceable about it, but it's such a hot button issue that perhaps some of the other students will get outraged by that, and some of these other students might cause a disturbance, even if the students wearing the black armbands themselves are not causing any disturbance themselves. So after catching wind of this, the school district, the school administration laid down the law and said there will be no black armbands in school. Well, in spite of that ruling, a number of students, Mr. Tinker among them, decided to wear a black armband to school, and he was duly suspended for a few weeks. He took that to court, and eventually it wound its way up to the U.S. Supreme Court, which held that was an improper restriction on that student's freedom of speech. If there's one phrase you've ever heard in connection with today's topic, it's probably a quote from this case that neither students nor teachers shed their constitutional rights to freedom of speech at the schoolhouse gate. And they still do possess those constitutional rights, although the exact boundaries of what those rights are obviously the subject of much litigation, but the administration can't simply say, well, no, the students have no rights here. Because, again, the administration of the school is the government, and the government may make no law respecting or abridging the freedom of speech. And here the court kind of zeroed in on the fact that, well, you know, what these students were doing, this was just a silent, passive protest. And first of all, even though kind of a threshold issue, even though there was actually no speaking involved on the part of the students, it was just a passive act of wearing this armband, the court recognized, well, no, when the Bill of Rights talks about the freedom of speech, it includes a lot of things, including wearing a black armband on your arm. So there's a threshold issue. They determined, well, yes, this is speech. But the court kind of zeroed in on the fact that, you know, there is no disorder or disturbance on the part of any of these students. It didn't interfere with the school curriculum in any way. It didn't interfere with the rights of other students in any way. Now, one of the issues that the administration again brought up was, well, you know, what if some other students are outraged by these black armbands? Well, the Supreme Court and the courts construing the First Amendment have been very reluctant to ever have what they sometimes refer to as a heckler's veto. So I'm going to go in and make some unpopular speech, and I'm going to be peaceable about it. But these other people on the other side of the issue might just get so outraged by my black armband that they might commit violence against me, or they might commit violence against somebody else. Well, the courts have been extremely reluctant to impose that, what they call a heckler's veto. You know, if that person does cause a disturbance, well, then that person ought to be dealt with according to law, rather than saying that other peaceful citizens can't exercise their constitutional rights just because somebody else will do something that they're clearly not supposed to be able to do. So in this case, the court upheld these students' right to wear their black armbands to school. But they did point out that, well, there are limits on this. You know, there might be some situations where a prohibition would be justified. Because obviously a school system can't, at some point the teacher and the administrator has to be up there talking, and all of the kids can't simply say that they are engaging in free speech and you know, speak their minds. So there can be some restrictions on it. And the court in this Tinker case noted that it can't be just a mere desire to avoid the discomfort and unpleasantness of listening to this. It has to be basically a legitimate pedagogical concern rather than especially anything that targets one particular expression of opinion. But once again, the court goes on to say that, yeah, well, even though there are these fundamental safeguards, yes, the kids do not shed their constitutional rights at the schoolhouse gate, but, you know, the local school officials do have the duty to prescribe and control conduct in the schools to a certain extent. Well, the so, you know, again, the black armband, the Tinker case, you know, especially today after, you know, after many years, you know, it's kind of almost surprising to suggest that that something like that would be restricted, although, you know, things like that keep coming up still. But kind of the other end of the spectrum, where I think we would say it's a pretty clear case that, yes, the administration probably did have the right to impose some restrictions on the student, was this Bethel School District versus Fraser case from 1986. This was also involved high school students, and it was a you know, school election for the student council officers or whatever, and there was an assembly in the school auditorium. And this Mr. Fraser was serving as the campaign manager for one of his classmates who was running for school office. And during this required assembly, he gave a speech in favor of his candidate, during which he, in the words of the court, and in the footnotes, if you want to hear the exact words, it appears in there, but he referred to his candidate in terms of an elaborate, graphic and explicit sexual metaphor. It was just full of double entendre, and Mr. Fraser was warned prior to the speech, saying, you know, this might not be a good idea to do this, but he did it nonetheless, and he was suspended. So he went to court. He also took it up to the Supreme Court, and of course he pointed at the Tinker case, saying, well, I was just, you know, like Mr. Tinker. I too did not shed my constitutional rights at the schoolhouse gate, and I was simply engaging in free speech. Well, no, the Supreme Court disagreed and upheld the suspension. And again, they pointed out that it is indeed an appropriate function of the schools to prohibit the use of vulgar and offensive terms in public discourse. So this is quite different from simply wearing a black armband or saying that I am opposed to war. And the school board and the school officials are vested with considerable discretion to make that determination. So once again, I think Fraser is a pretty easy case, and Tinker is probably a pretty easy case. But you know, at some point, a line has to be drawn at some point, and of course, finding the exact spot for drawing that line is a subject for more litigation that we could undoubtedly talk for many more hours about. The thing highlighted by this, though, is we should keep in mind that on this, you know, on free speech and free press, those are areas where the government official, whether it's a school official or a state official or a federal official, if the official wants to, or if, you know, if the governing body wants to, they can, on this, they can always err on the side of caution and give students or give the public more free speech rights than they're entitled to, and thus avoiding any successful lawsuits. And that's true in many constitutional rights. Now, obviously, there might be many non-constitutional concerns. Obviously, there are legitimate, pedagogical concerns and discipline concerns that the school has to worry about. But they can't avoid all this constitutional stuff altogether by just saying, well, the kids can say anything that they want to, which I'm not advocating, but that would be the way to avoid it. Well, as we move to the Establishment Clause and the Free Exercise Clause, we then reach an area where there's really no safe side on which the government or the school board can err. Because the Establishment and Free Exercise Clauses say that Congress, including the school board, shall pass no law with respect to establishing a religion, nor shall they in any way restrict the people from the free exercise of religion. Well, here's an area then where if you err on the side of caution with respect to one of those, you err on the side of caution and say, we're never going to do anything that could conceivably be thought of as a violation of the Establishment Clause. Well, if you take that stance, then it's pretty likely that at some point you're going to violate the Free Exercise Clause. On the other hand, if you take the position that, we're never going to do anything to violate the Free Exercise Clause, we are going to err on the side of caution and make sure that the right of the people to freely exercise their religion is never abridged. Well, when you make that determination, then chances are, at some point, you're going to violate the Establishment Clause. So this is a more difficult area because you can't simply err on the side of caution. This is often an area where you have to seek the advice of professional counsel and on what exactly you can do here. But to give you an idea of what some of the issues are, we have a few cases here. And before we proceed much further, we will give our first set of code words. First of all, I will hold up on the screen the code word for those of you taking the video version of the case. So if you're taking this program for Iowa credit, you will need to use this word. So I'll hold that on the screen a little bit. If you're taking it for Wisconsin credit only and you don't have access to the video, you can also give me Wisconsin audio code word number one, which is apple. The first Wisconsin audio code word is apple, and the first Iowa video code word is the one shown on the screen. Well, moving on to the Establishment and the Free Exercise Clause, these days, I don't know if this is an entirely fair categorization, but it seems to me that these days the pendulum is on the part of school administrators often is to err on the side of never violating the Free Exercise Clause, to err on the side of never violating the Establishment Clause, which, as we'll see, sometimes puts them in peril of violating the Free Exercise Clause. At some point when the pendulum swings back the other way, it will be equally as perilous a situation. But the Establishment Clause is the one that seems to generate the most worries, but as you can see here, it probably generates the least litigation. So maybe that erring on the side of never violating the Establishment Clause, maybe an administrator really ought to think a little bit more in terms of not violating free exercise. And there's relatively little litigation on Supreme Court cases on the Establishment Clause with respect to public education. And the cases that are out there, I think, are pretty easy cases. Just about any lawyer looking at these probably would have come to about the same conclusion, and they're relatively old cases. But 1971 is kind of one of the first leading ones, the case of Lemon versus Kurtzman. And in that case, Rhode Island had a statute that supplemented the salary of certain private school teachers. So if a given private school was paying less per pupil than the average for the public schools, well, then the state would step in and say, well, you know, for the benefit of those students, so that they get a good education, we will supplement the salary of the teachers as long as they're teaching, secular, non-religious subjects. So the English teacher at a private school and the math teacher at the private school would receive a 15% bonus from the from either the state or the school board, but from public funds in any event, even though they were teaching in a private school. The purpose of that is, well, you know, every student in the state is entitled to, free public education of high quality. Some students go to the public school where 100% of the teacher's salary is paid public funds. These students, they're getting part of that. They're getting 15% of their teacher's salary paid by public funds. But the Supreme Court struck that down because it's either all or almost all of the teachers receiving that benefit were actually teachers in Catholic schools. So it even though secular private schools would have qualified, that wasn't how it worked out. And the court found that unconstitutional. And in so doing, they kind of came up with a three-part test. For a state action to be held constitutional, in other words, for it to be proper, all three of these prongs have to be met. First of all, the action has to have a secular purpose. Well, here I think the court agreed that yes, it had a secular purpose, because the purpose of this was to make sure that even students who opted out of the public system were guaranteed a quality education in non-religious subjects. So yeah, they conceded that it probably had a secular purpose. And in the second prong of the test, the state action can't have its primary effect of either advancing or inhibiting religion. Maybe a little bit closer call, but they said, well, no, it's not really advancing any particular religion. In fact, it was open to non-religious private schools as well, even though they just didn't happen to take advantage of it. So maybe that wasn't the primary effect. But the third prong of that test, which they held this statute failed, was that the action may not result in an excessive entanglement with religion. And they said, no, here, that's what's going to happen. If this is allowed to stand, there will just be an excessive entanglement. Because the teacher has to keep track of how many hours they're teaching math and how many hours they're teaching English versus how many hours they're teaching religion. And there's going to have to be a lot of administrative interaction between the religious school and the state. So that in this case, it fails just because of that excessive entanglement. And maybe because it's kind of a close call on whether it advances or inhibits religion. But in this case, they conceded that it did have a secular purpose. A similar scheme was tried in the state of Michigan in 1985. That was Grand Rapids School District versus Ball. Instead of entangling them by, supplementing the salary of this person, well, we'll send public school teachers to the private school. So the religion teacher is an employee of the parochial school, but the math teacher is an employee of the public school district. And he just happens to be teaching in that building that day to educate these students on non-religious subjects. Well, they said that that also fails the test that we announced in Lemon versus Kurtzman. And here it was kind of they said, well, this is kind of here Yeah, we still have maybe have less of that excessive entanglement because, you know, when the math teacher goes home at 3 o'clock, you know, he's off the clock and he gets his only paycheck from the public school district. So maybe there's no entanglement there. But in this case, it's kind of, it fails that second prime because the primary effect of this is to either inhibit or in this case, advance a particular religion because the state is really providing this resource to a private school. They expounded a little bit more on what that primary effect test really means. The test of that kind of boils down to whether it's likely that it'll be perceived by how it will be perceived out in the public, whether it will be perceived by adherence to that particular religion as an endorsement, or somebody who does not adhere to that particular religion, whether that will be perceived by them as a disapproval of their religious beliefs or religious choices. So, and once again, those are kind of the, administrators, this will change, that pendulum, keeps swinging, but right now, my perception is that how a lot of school districts view it is they view the establishment clause as kind of the hot button of the day. They want to make sure that they're never perceived as violating that establishment clause. And of course, there's some more litigation on it. Those two cases are not the be-all and end-all of it. But those are really the two main cases that have gone up to the U.S. Supreme Court. So there's not a lot of litigation and perhaps less peril when it comes to the establishment clause than school officials occasionally think. So, because when you go out of your way never to violate the Establishment Clause, you run the risk of violating the Free Exercise Clause, which has, again, surprisingly little litigation before the Supreme Court, but a little bit more, and these cases are probably a little bit more fleshed out than some of the Establishment Clause cases. And here, kind of the leading case, free exercise. We usually think of, well, what are kids allowed to do once they are in school? Well, kind of the extreme of that, the extreme case is, well, does the kid have to go to school in the first place? On that issue, the court weighed in Wisconsin versus Yoder from 1972. Wisconsin, like most states, has a compulsory education law saying that kids have to go to school or be properly schooled within certain ages. I don't know right offhand what the Wisconsin statute says. I'm guessing it probably said and still says that they have to be in school till they're about 16. Well, the Amish parent, Mr. Yoder here, his religious belief and that of his particular group of Amish was that children should be educated to the eighth grade, but not past. That higher education past that point will give unnecessary worldly influences on their children. Everybody, the courts all agreed that was a legitimate belief on his part. He kept his kids home from school and passed the eighth grade, and he was fined something like $10 for violating that statute, but he was fined nonetheless, and brought the case to the Wisconsin Supreme Court that upheld his $10 fine, and he took that to the U.S. Supreme Court. The Supreme Court came down and said, no, the fact that he has one of his legitimate religious belief was that children should not be educated past eighth grade, he was fined $10 because he adhered to that religious belief. And that cannot be allowed to stand. So his the judgment of the lower courts was reversed because it violated the free exercise clause. A little bit more recent case from Minnesota, kind of holding the same thing. It's a Minnesota Court of Appeals case, but once again, a parent who believed perhaps even a little bit more strongly than this Amish gentleman, Mr. Yoder, the parents of this child, TK, decided to homeschool their child to avoid the public school system entirely. And of course, there is a homeschooling that's appropriate in Minnesota. That's allowed by Minnesota statute. But you have to at least send the kids in every now and then to take the standardized tests to make sure that that they are learning what they're supposed to learn in your home school. And this parent believed that doing that would risk eternal damnation, sending them either to a public school or even a parochial school to have that kind of testing done. And he refused to have that. And the courts agreed that, well, that's that was a sincerely held belief on this parent's part. Therefore, the action of the child welfare people involving themselves in the case was improper. So once again, you see that the not a lot of litigation, but as you can see, even an extreme example of not sending the kids to school in the first place, even refusing to do the testing, even in those extreme cases, as long as it's a sincerely held belief on the part of the person, the courts are extremely reluctant to overturn that. So again, my suggestion is that if you're worried about a safe side, you're probably better off. Obviously, you have to balance the concerns, both constitutional and policy concerns, on the other side. But free speech. Well, unlike free speech, there is no safe side, but I would say erring on the side of free exercise is probably a little bit closer to the safe side. So again, we've just covered the very basics of it. We'll hit on one of these again here to kind of highlight this. A federal case coming out of Minnesota, Minneapolis, about religious school clubs using the facilities. And we'll see that free exercise is pretty jealously guarded by the courts. One hot button issue, that people think of in terms of the First Amendment in education is clothing. Whether the school can impose dress codes and that sort of thing. And of course, those are constitutional issues, or even if the school could, public school can require a uniform. And that's kind of thought of as maybe a hot button issue. But interestingly, that subject has never really squarely come before the U.S. Supreme Court. So we don't have any Supreme Court cases on that point. And actually very few lower court cases. But of course, bear in mind that the Tinker case, the one that kind of started it all, the black armbands to protest the Vietnam War. Well, of course, that's an article of clothing that they pretty quickly decided constituted speech. So I think other articles of clothing would probably could easily be grouped in with speech. The only Eighth Circuit case I could find, for those of you in Minnesota and Iowa, part of the Eighth Circuit, the only one I could find there was this Lowry versus Watson Chapel School District. And there, interestingly, what happened is the school started having school uniforms. What the students did in that case, they wore the uniform, but they were protesting the uniform. They didn't refuse to wear the uniform, they protested the uniform. And how they protested the uniform was by wearing black armbands, just like in the Tinker case. And they were especially careful not to wear the black armbands over their uniform. So they were actually wound up wearing black wristbands. But the school took some punitive action against them. And in this case, the Eighth Circuit said, well, no, that's protected speech. So that is a permissible thing for them to do, to wear their black armbands to protest the new uniforms. But again, no discussion in that case, though, on the actual uniforms. You know, does a non-conformist student have the right to come to school wearing something other than his uniform? Well, they didn't address that issue. But there are some First Amendment issues lurking there. And I do have a cite here to a fairly recent, over 10 years old, but fairly recent law review article covering that subject. So if you would like some more guidance, I commend you toward that. Well, that brings us to our second set of code words. Once again, those of you in the Hawkeye State, or those of you who whose state requires you to watch a video rather than merely listen to the audio, make note of the code word that is now appearing on your screen. For those of you in Wisconsin, New York, and other states that permit you to get credit merely by listening to the audio version of this program, the second code word for Wisconsin is banana. The second code word for Wisconsin is banana, in keeping with our fruit theme for that. But here once again is the second Iowa code word, and there will be one more coming up here in a few more minutes. Well, we've talked about clothing. Like I say, the First Amendment talks about freedom of the press. And what is the press? Well, you think of the press as the Minneapolis Star Tribune or the Des Moines Register. Well, what about the school newspaper? The students do not completely shed their constitutional rights when they come in. But especially since the school district is paying for the ink and for the paper, there's a quite large amount of leeway in what rights what permissible powers the school district has to control that editorial content. The test boils down to that it's permissible if it's reasonably related to a legitimate pedagogical concern. There, I got to use the word pedagogical yet once again, straight from the court's opinion. So, if you're teaching your students, this is the way real reporters do things out in the real world, just like if you're teaching metal working class, and you say this is the way real machinists operate out in the real world. Well, you can say the same thing. This is the way reporters do it out in the real world. They write their articles this way, just like in shop class, people out in the real world make their widgets this way. So the administration generally has pretty broad control with respect to those publications. One of the main restrictions is basically, viewpoint discrimination. If you allow the Republicans to put their editorial in the paper, and then you exclude the Democrats from doing exactly the same thing, well, then you're probably going to run into problems. But other than those extreme cases, you're probably on. The administration is probably on pretty solid ground with respect to reasonable restrictions, related to legitimate teaching concerns. Once again, if you want to do a little bit further reading, there is an annotation here collecting some of the Supreme Court cases on the subject, so you can you can find that in the library. The next issue we're going to talk about is distribution of literature. That subject comes up. Can students hand out literature about political issues or religious issues? What are the restrictions on that? Once they're legitimately walked through that schoolhouse gate, they did not shed those constitutional rights. So just as I can go around to the people here today and hand out political or religious literature if I'm so inclined, in general, students probably have that right, subject once again to those legitimate concerns that were talked about in that in the second case we talked about. Mr. Fraser in his speech for the school assembly. The case that I have here from the Eighth Circuit, there's not a lot of cases on the subject, and I think everybody pretty agreed this Doe case, Doe versus South Iron School District, from the Eighth Circuit from about 5 years ago, kind of an extreme case, and I don't think the court had too much difficulty saying, you crossed the line when you allowed this. Because in this case, it was the Gideons, a religious group who hands out Bibles in various situations. Well, they allowed the school district allowed members of the Gideons to come into school during classroom time, the lesson was put on hold while the members of the Gideons handed out Bibles to elementary school students. That violated the Establishment Clause, and I think that's pretty easy to see because because it was not a forum that was generally open to the public. Stand in the corner in the park and hand out literature to people. You need to sign in and get the principal's permission to come into school. So it's not open to the public, but even then they said that because it's content based, saying we're restricting these people from doing it, handing out religious material. It is strict scrutiny does have to be applied there. The court is going to look very, very closely at that. But they said no. In this case, that kind of went overboard because the establishment concerns this. This certainly looks like the establishment of religion because the students are they're a captive audience and they're there to do it. But, so in the second paragraph I have quoted in the materials here, they say, basically it goes overboard. But if you read the dicta in the first paragraph that I have quoted here, you will see that other than in very extreme examples of like that, the court is going to provide, or going to, really scrutinize any actions where students are, or anybody else is told, no, you can't hand out literature, and especially if it's, you can't hand out this particular kind of literature. But once again, it's a pretty extreme case where the court actually steps in and says, no, you crossed the line in this one. There does not seem to be a lot of jurisprudence saying that the school administrator may restrict that in less extreme situations. And again, if you look at the dicta in the first paragraph of that opinion from the Eighth Circuit, that one's not from the Supreme Court, but that's the law of the land here in Minnesota and Iowa and probably most of the other circuits. Well, we'll just hit quickly another kind of establishment clause issue is a student religious group or a religious group meeting in a public school facility. Here we have to go a little bit beyond the Constitution because in an earlier case involving the drug peyote. I can't think of the name of the case, but I believe it was from Florida. A Native American was prosecuted for using a drug called peyote, which was, he said, no, that's part of my religion that I use that. Even though it's classified as a narcotic, that's my legitimate religious belief. And over the years, the U.S. Supreme Court said, well, no, we don't think that way. Well, a lot of state Supreme Courts and state legislators and even the U.S. Congress have looked at that and said, well, no, I think we ought to restore some of that protection we ought to give a little bit more protection to people who want to express their religious views by actions that might otherwise be prohibited. So this Equal Access Act, U.S. Passed by the Congress, basically says that if a public school gets federal dollars, and if they if they're open to groups at all for renting out rooms or loaning out rooms for meetings and so forth, they are required to provide equal access, and they cannot discriminate against groups simply on the grounds that there will be religious speech taking place during those meetings. And that law itself was challenged, saying, well, yes, you're erring on the side of free exercise, but you're violating the Establishment Clause when you do that. Well, that went up to the Supreme Court in the Mergens case, and Mergens held that no, that is not a violation of the Establishment Clause. That Equal Access Act has to be enforced. Well, a recent case in 2012 started out here in Minnesota, Minneapolis School District, Child Evangelism Fellowship versus Special School District Number 1. Well, the school district there, and the I think I have the site for it for the. MnStat 124D.19 provides for various community education programs and sets out some guidelines for that. Well, pursuant to that statute, the Minneapolis Public Schools had after-school enrichment programs. They had Girl Scouts, Boy Scouts, Big Brothers and Big Sisters, various groups like that that met after school. The children attending those programs had access to school lunch program for the afternoon snacks or whatever were provided, and they also had access to the activity bus that took them home. Well, one of the groups that was participating in that was called the Good News Club, and it was a religious organization. And one day, a district employee walked by their room and overheard them praying. Decided that that should not be allowed in the public school because she was worried about the school violating the Establishment Clause. Well, the court held that that action in excluding them was not proper, as long as under the Equal Access Act and under the Constitution itself, that's viewpoint discrimination. Because other groups were allowed to come in and say, you can be a better student by doing A, B, and C. And they were allowed to say that. This group was coming in and saying, you can be a better student by doing A, B, and C. Except their A, B, and C were religious things. And the Supreme Court, or the Eighth Circuit, held that in addition to violating the Equal Access Act, that's really a violation of the Constitution itself. We're in kind of the final stretch here. I will just give us our third set of code words, the third Iowa video code word. For those of you in states that need to watch the video, that code word is now appearing on your screen. And for those of you in Wisconsin, New York, and other states where you can just listen to the audio, the third audio word, again, in keeping with our fruit and vegetable theme, is carrot, C-A-R-R-O-T-T. The third Wisconsin code word is carrot. And the Iowa word is shown on your screen.
Well, we'll just conclude here with some of these last topics. It looks like I had little difficulty in filling out the time. And the last case here is just interesting because it's interesting. It's a very recent case decided by the district court here in Minnesota just a couple of weeks ago. RS versus Minnewaska School District. And here, you know, and this strikes me as a little bit tame. The student got herself detention because at home on her Facebook page, she said that she hated the hall monitor because the hall monitor was mean. And that posting, I hate her because she's mean. She posted that on Facebook, so it was visible to her friends. It was not visible to the public or to the principal or anybody else. But one of those friends printed it out and handed it to the principal. And she got called in and got herself a detention. Well, she was a little bit upset about that, so the next day on Facebook she put, "I want to know who the blankety blank," and she used blanks. "I want to know who told on me." She was called in on that too, and then she was given an in-school suspension, and she was prevented from attending the ski trip. And the stated reasons for the discipline were insubordination and dangerous, harmful, and nuisance substances and articles. So they went through checking boxes. And, well, an article is something that you write. And you write in the newspaper, right? Well, this was an article. It was a dangerous article. So she got suspended because of this dangerous article, namely her Facebook posting. Well, she took it to federal court, and the federal court ruled in her favor that it was the school district brought a motion to dismiss, but the court said, no, this case can proceed. Now, she still has to prove this case, and this case presumably is still out there pending. But the court said, yeah, if she can prove that's what happened, that's a good case. Because the court says, well, this was not a true threat. It wasn't calculated to, it's not a serious safety risk. Even though, she should have realized that people at the school might see this. But still, they said it's a far cry from cases that would justify intervention. And kind of interestingly, off the topic of today's program, the other issue that was going on in there was the Fourth Amendment violation, because among other things, she was asked, and there's probably an issue, a factual issue, of whether she consented or not, but the issue of, well, she had to turn over her password so the school administration could, go through her account and see what other people, she thinks were mean to her, and so the court also said, there are some Fourth Amendment issues going on there because she had a reasonable expectation of privacy. Just quickly hitting on book censorship, you can look at this PICO case. If a school district removes a book from the library for content reasons, well, they're probably violating the First Amendment by doing that. Now, on the other hand, the school only has limited funds, and the courts do not require a school district to buy books just so that they have every possible book in their library. So, as a practical matter, what it kind of boils down to is, librarians have broad discretion on what books they can buy in the first place, but very limited discretion on what books they can get rid of once they're already sitting on the shelf. And then finally, I'll just hit quickly on the Pledge of Allegiance. 1943, a time of war, a student in West Virginia refused to take part in the Pledge of Allegiance because of his religious views, and the court said, no, you can't be compelled to pledge allegiance to something, unless that is really what your belief is. I do quote the Minnesota statute here that I think accommodates that PICO case very well, because it says, the student can opt out. But in Minnesota, the
The school is required to lead the students in the Pledge of Allegiance a certain number of times, and it specifies how they can do that. Interestingly, though, if that's just way too burdensome for some particular school district, the individual district can opt out of it. But it does require an affirmative vote of the school board on an annual basis. So I guess the compromise there is if the school board wants to keep the Pledge of Allegiance out, well, they have to go on record, I guess, once a year, saying that they are opposed to the Pledge of Allegiance. Well, that brings us to the end of the materials. I hope you enjoyed it. I'll pause briefly for any questions here, which I don't see any. For those of you listening or watching online, if you do have any questions, feel free to either email them to me or post them on the forum that will be available for that. We'll answer them within in the 2 business days as required. And once again, I have additional programs available on my website, conference call programs, generally $25 per credit. So be sure and check those out. And then also, as the reporting deadline looms here at the end of the calendar year in Wisconsin, Iowa, Nebraska, I will have live programs in various cities in those states and perhaps elsewhere, and of course also programs here in Minnesota. So thank you very much for joining me today, and I look forward to seeing all of you at future programs.